Hi, and welcome to the Friday, May 31st pre-primary episode of On Iowa Politics. On this week's podcast, fundraising in Iowa's State House campaign, the one-year anniversary of the downtown Davenport building collapse, and we take a quick peek at the first district. We just joked about having to keep track of those district changes, and I just did it again. The first congressional district is what we'll look at today. Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Murphy, the Des Moines bureau chief for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. It's summer. It's vacation time. There's a lot of things going on. We got a skeleton crew, but we're still going to deliver for you. We have with us today Gazette Deputy Bureau Chief Tom Barton. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Aaron.
And Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times is with us as well. Hello, Sarah.
Greetings, Aaron.
And that's it. Our producer, Bailey Cheehan, are you ready to jump in with some politics talk if we need you at any point?
I can if you absolutely need it.
All right. We'll let you know. Keep warming up in the bullpen. All right. First up, before we go into full politics, I wanted to talk with Sarah about the one-year anniversary of the downtown Davenport building collapse. The Quad City Times has been putting together a batch of great stories on that. Loyal listeners of the podcast know this story well. But Sarah, give us a super quick summary for the uninitiated, and then tell us all about that coverage that the Quad City Times has put together on the one-year anniversary of this event.
Yeah, so long story short is that a year ago, May 28th, 2023, the west wall of a six-story apartment building in downtown Davenport collapsed. That collapse killed three men, caused dozens of residents to lose their homes and belongings, and rescuers had to amputate a woman's leg to free her from the rubble. Since that collapse, the city had hired investigators to investigate what happened, why the collapse happened, and they determined that it was some brickwork that had been done, that there were two root causes of the collapse, that there was brickwork done in the days leading up to the collapse, removing those layers of brick, and then inadequate shoring to support the wall, and misidentifying the wall as structural, holding up the building, ultimately is what caused that wall to collapse. And so our stories, we looked back at a couple different things. So we looked at the cost, what it cost the city of Davenport, and we interviewed a couple of tenants, former tenants of the building, and how losing all of their possessions, all of the things that made them was really tough to rebuild from. And then we also looked at what changes have been made in the last year. So to start with, the city of Davenport was the primary responding agency. So it cost them about $3.26 million for contracts to demolish the building and dispose of the asbestos contaminated material in a landfill, pay for tenant relief. So tenants got $6,000 if they were living in 324 Main Street, and businesses that were located there got $25,000. And then residents who were in surrounding buildings who were displaced also got some relief. And that was from American Rescue Plan Act funds that the city had set aside for transitional housing. So there was a lot, there was a big expense to the city of Davenport. They also reimbursed like the county, and they paid for investigators to come in and look at the collapse and what happened, like I mentioned earlier. So then the second story we did, my colleague Tom Lowy and I interviewed two residents, and really just about what they lost in the collapse, and how even though it's they're thankful for their lives, they're thankful for their efforts to, you know, rescue them or their pets, they're having to rebuild what makes them them. And there are a lot of mementos and things that they can't get back. So artwork, notes from encouraging teachers, books, things that meant a lot to these two tenants. And so, and then we also talked about what, or we did a story about what's changed since a year ago. And really there's a lot of ideas for how the city of Davenport can change its rental inspection policies, but there have, according to city staff, there have not been any substantial changes to Davenport's rental codes. I will say, though, that they have funded a study by those same investigative firms to review Davenport city codes, and they're preparing presentations right now for the city council to potentially decide on any rental code changes and inspection changes to their policies. And I will also note that there was another building in downtown, the Schricker Apartments, that there were a couple dozen tenants that were evacuated because that building had structural concerns. And so I think that example kind of represents what the city of Davenport maybe could have done with 324 Main Street. They hired their own structural engineer to come in and assess the building when city inspectors had concerns, and structural engineer determined that there was enough concern about the structural integrity of the building that tenants should be evacuated. So, but there's still conversations about what should happen to tenants who are evacuated from unsafe buildings and how the city or others can support them. So one idea that a Quad Cities Tenant Alliance, which has really gained a lot of traction since the collapse of the Davenport, has proposed is a rent abatement policy, which would essentially allow the city to declare a unit. It'd be like a second or third enforcement tool option where the city of Davenport could declare, okay, the tenant in this unit does not have to pay rent until these life safety or health safety issues, such as like no heat, are resolved. And so Iowa City has done this, and they've reported quite a bit of success. The inspector, I think his title is like chief inspector or senior housing inspector. He had said that they've used it 14 times in 7 years, and they've been able to get landlord compliance. So they haven't used it too often, but it has encouraged compliance from landlords because it provides that extra incentive, one, for tenants to report, two, for landlords to make the fixes if they're not collecting rent, and three, if landlords then are prohibited from evicting their tenants, which is another part of the policy. So those are the three stories that we put together for the anniversary.
Yeah, and those are out on the website right now, right, Sarah? Those stories?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. All right. And the other thing I wanted to check in with you on this is and we've done this occasionally. I'm always curious what's still going on with this? What's ongoing? What are you waiting to hear? What story are you still tracking from all of this? What's the ongoing story right now?
Absolutely. There's definitely a lot of different stories. But I think the main question that the public wants to know the answer to is anyone going to be criminally held responsible for this tragedy? So three men have died, and the public really wants to know, okay, who's going to be held responsible for that? And so the Division of Criminal Investigation has completed a report and given it to the county attorney, her office will then decide whether criminal charges will be brought against anyone.
Is there a timeline for that decision?
There is not immediately. Yeah. It sounds like, so the county attorney is Kelly Cunningham. She told me that she has a lot of cases right now and that she hasn't had time to fully review the report. She said it's a really complicated case. There's a lot of actors with the building owner. There's structural engineers. There's workers who did brickwork. There's past owners. So there's a lot of different people involved, and there still remains the fact that there are three people dead after a building fell down.
Yeah. All right. That's great stuff. I encourage everybody to check out those stories by Sarah and the team. And as we just talked about, still plenty to follow along, which the Quad City Times team will, and we will hear on the podcast as well. All right, let's jump back into politics. Now, this coming Tuesday, June 4th, is Iowa's primary elections. So as a sort of public service announcement, first of all, here, if you're so inclined, make sure you get out and vote in your chosen political party's primary elections. Our Caleb McCullough this week put together a report on some of the fundraising in Iowa's statehouse campaigns. Caleb, however, had the nerve to take some time off, and he isn't available for this week's podcast. So he's left us to do his dirty work. Tom, let me ask you to fill in for Caleb here, our bureau teammate. There were some pretty interesting numbers in Caleb's story. What, anything in there stand out to you?
To be honest, I guess what stood out to me more than the numbers are the kind of politics involved for the candidates who are challenging incumbents and some of the groups who are getting involved in some of these primary races. So, for example, with Senate District 30, you have incumbent Republican Senator Waylon Brown of Osage facing a primary challenge from Republican Doug Campbell of Mason City. That district covers Cerro Gordo, Worth, Mitchell counties, part of Floyd County. But what's interesting there is that Campbell is focusing his campaign heavily on opposition to carbon capture pipelines that would sequester the CO2 emitted by Iowa ethanol plants and inject it deep into the ground to take advantage of federal tax credits and low carbon markets. Summit Carbon Solutions, is seeking a permit to build a pipeline that would, I think it would cross all four counties in that Senate district. And opponents of the pipeline have accused Senator Brown of opposing efforts to stop its construction. And so I just think that that's an interesting issue, in that primary race, looking at a Republican incumbent and kind of, pitting, Republicans who, are strong and adamant about protecting property rights against those who at the same time are, wanting to protect and help bolster Iowa's ethanol industry and renewable fuels and agriculture sectors and economies, and helping to, provide new markets and opportunities, for them to, survive and remain profitable in the long term.
Right. Sorry, I was just going to, I was just going to insert in there really quick. That's a really good point. The money aside, because as an incumbent, Senator Brown has significantly outraised his opponent there. It's going to kind of give us a look at how much juice this specific issue has as a campaign issue, especially in a Republican primary, doesn't it? Because like you said, Doug Campbell is making this the sole focus of his campaign. There's no bigger target for this than Senator Brown. As you noted, he's essentially the point person as getting that slowed down in the Senate Republican caucus. So yeah, that's a great one, Tom. That's going to be fascinating to see.
Yeah, and the opponents to these carbon capture pipelines and these landowners that, would be affected by the Summit Carbon Pipeline and its potential use of eminent domain have been, a vocal constant presence, at the state house. But as you said, Aaron, it's going to be interesting to see how much that issue is really going to resonate with, this particular sector of Republican voters in Iowa.
Yeah, as I often say, is it a lever pulling issue? We see any number of issues that bring hundreds of people to the Capitol during a legislative session, but does it change voters' minds at the end of the day? That's not always the case. We're going to get a fascinating case study right here in this primary on exactly that.
Yeah, absolutely. Another one that stood out to me is the House District 60 race, where you have Republican incumbent Jane Bloomingdale of Northwood facing a primary challenge from Republican John Rosenfeld in a district that covers Worth Mitchell and parts of Cerro Gordo and Floyd counties. And what stands out to me in that race is you have Republican incumbent Jane Bloomingdale, who is endorsed by the Iowa Farm Bureau and the National Rifle Association. So, you know, two prominent, you know, groups who, you know, have long supported Iowa conservatives, again, facing off against Rosenfeld, who has been endorsed by the Family Leader, a conservative Christian political group. And the Family Leader, in announcing its support and endorsement for Bloomingdale's Republican challenger, John Rosenfeld, you know, goes after her for what it, you know, says is, you know, her lengthy record of breaking from her party to vote against what it says are protections for babies in the womb. So, you know, clearly the Family Leader, you know, not thinking that, you know, Jane Bloomingdale is, you know, as ardent a pro-life legislator than they would like. And yet, again, you have the Iowa Farm Bureau and the National Rifle Association, you know, weighing in and saying that they support her and they endorse her. So it's interesting.
I gotta confess here, Tom, what would that be based on? Did she vote against the fetal heartbeat bill?
I don't know about that. I would need to look into that. I'm not certain of that. I'm wondering more if it has to do maybe with her thoughts and views on so-called personhood bills that you know, the Family Leader and other conservative anti-abortion groups, you know, support, you know, so-called life at conception bills, personhood bills, you know, that that say that, you know, life begins, you know, at conception or fertilization.
Yeah. So here it is. And if you're one of our new YouTube viewers, you might have noticed that I jumped on my laptop here to look this up. Lifetime, she voted against the 2018. She was one of the votes against the 2018 fetal heartbeat bill. I'm not seeing a hit on when they redid it in the special session last year. And then I found another Capital Dispatch story that said she also voted against the proposed constitutional amendment, which they ultimately ditched that anyways with the fetal heartbeat bill in the courts. But she was a no on that one too. So there's at least two right there that are clearly what the Family Leader is talking about when they talk about that endorsement. Yeah, that's another interesting one, Tom.
Yeah, and I mean, that one's going to be really interesting just because of how focal abortion politics are, you know, in this election cycle, this campaign cycle, and if that is something that is going to be at the forefront of Iowa Republican voters' minds, because, you know, we're awaiting a decision from the Iowa Supreme Court on that fetal heartbeat bill that's supposed to come out the end of next month, right? Yeah,
at the latest. Yep,
at the latest. Right. Yep. So yeah, so that's going to be interesting to see. You know, it wasn't all that surprising to see that as an incumbent, you know, Jane Bloomingdale has quite a bit of cash on hand. You know, a sizable amount compared to her primary opponent. Well, I guess those were the main ones that really kind of, you know, jumped out to me, you know, and will be interesting to see again, kind of how those play out.
Yeah, how those two specific issues. Absolutely right. The only other thing I'll add is this year we don't have the governor endorsing in the primaries. You mentioned the family leader in at least one there, and I know they've endorsed in some other primaries as well. That's probably the most interesting one that you highlighted, but unlike a couple of years ago when Governor Reynolds got involved over the school choice issue, she's staying out of the primaries this season. So again, those elections coming up on Tuesday, make sure you, if you'd like to get out and vote in those, and obviously we'll have results to talk about on next week's podcast. Wrap it up this week, and we're actually going to go back to Sarah. Speaking of that primary, Sarah's working on a preview of the first congressional district Republican primary between incumbent Marionette Miller Meeks and David. And I understand we have to do an on Iowa politics correction here, Sarah, and say it's David Pouch that's running against Miller Meeks, not David Patch, as we've been saying it.
Yes, I do. I do sincerely apologize. I when I first met him, I misheard him. I thought he was saying his name was David Patch, like pumpkin or strawberry patch, but it sounds like he normally says it's pronounced pouch, like kangaroo pouch.
Oh, okay.
So my deep apologies. This is why I work in print and not radio. So
well, I always say we only got to know how to spell them, not how to say them. Usually the podcast throws a wrinkle in that. So Sarah, you were again, as we sit here and record on Thursday afternoon, it sounds like you just very recently here spoke with both of those candidates. So give us a little tease of what you heard from them, and then tell us when we should watch for that preview story.
Yeah, so as most listeners probably know, Southeast Iowa, two-term Representative Marionette Miller Meeks facing a challenge from the right flank from Davenport's David Pouch. So that's going to take me a little bit. Pouch. David Pouch, he's not as well funded as you typically see. He's raised about $35,000. Marionette Miller Meeks has raised $2.9 million in the in that same amount of time. But in their pitches for Republican votes, Marionette Miller Meeks, she says she's going to keep on pushing to slow illegal immigration and encouraging more pathways for legal immigration, wants to cut down on inflation and reduce prescription drug prices. David Pouch, he's a prayer breakfast organizer and is very, his central campaign pitch is that he thinks that Marionette Miller Meeks is not voting conservatively enough. So in particular, he's criticized her vote for the Respect for Marriage Act, which protects same-sex and interracial marriages that have already been performed and are protected by states. And he also has criticized her voting to certify the 2020 election in January 2021. And he thinks that the election was, that there was a lot of fraud in the election. He thinks that Congress should go back and decertify the 2020 election and void most of current President Biden's administration's actions, if not all of their actions, and because he thinks that that presidency is illegitimate. And
sorry, Sarah, just to insert here, which we would normally do in a story, but they'll do it verbally here in the podcast. There was no evidence of that ever confirmed, and dozens upon dozens of court challenges that either rejected those allegations or were thrown out altogether. So those are, as in the world we know, baseless claims. Back to you, Sarah. Sorry.
Yeah. And so when I asked Marionette Miller Meeks about this, she defended those votes. And, in her review of case law, she felt like, existing marriages should be protected if it's legal in that state, and that there were religious protections for religious freedom in that bill. And then with the 2020 election, similarly, she said she talked with constitutional law experts and determined that that was the correct vote for her. I think it'll be a really interesting race. You look at some other primary challengers that aren't very super well funded. Like, so Jim Carlin most recently challenged Chuck Grassley, got about 26% of the vote to Chuck Grassley's 73%. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how much, see how far David Pouch is able to go. We're seeing a lot of David Pouch signs in Scott County. And so, you know, obviously signs aren't a measure of support necessarily, but it'll be an interesting primary.
What we came up with the holy trinity of anecdotal evidence last week was signs, applause lines, and what was the third one? Now it's escaping me. Shoot. It'll come to me
like
later.
Crowd size.
Yeah, I think that was it. Crowd size, applause lines, and street signs. That's how we, in the absence of good polling, that's how we judge.
The other thing I just also wanted to note was that there have been several county parties or central committees that have censured Marionette Miller Meeks over her votes. So David Pouch is really campaigning hard on that the party faithful aren't liking her votes and stances.
Yeah, that's a good. I like that you brought up there, Sarah, the Jim Carlin Chuck Grassley primary from a couple years ago, kind of as a benchmark of how, you know, what percentage of the Republican primary electorate there is in Iowa that's hungering to go farther right, and we'll see how this outcome compares to that. That's a good one. All right, so again, something else to watch for on Tuesday, and we will have plenty to talk about on next week's podcast, and hopefully the whole gang's ready again, or at least more of us. But good job by the folks here today. Another great discussion. That'll do it for this episode of On Iowa Politics. If you're not already, please subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice or on YouTube now, and smash that like button. And you can also find the podcast each week on your preferred Gazette or Lee newspaper website. And now that you've heard the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll receive all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. You can subscribe to that free newsletter at the Gazette's website, thegazette.com. And lastly, don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Muscatine Journal, Cedar Rapids Gazette, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Mason City Globe Gazette, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Sioux City Journal. And on that, Sarah, I forgot, when will that preview story, the first district preview, do you have a best guess for when readers should watch for that?
Either tomorrow or Saturday. Or Friday, well, wait, Saturday. We're Friday or Saturday.
Yeah.
We're
recording. Yeah. Yep. So watch that. It'll be up this weekend. Make sure you catch it. All right. I See You by Silence featuring Riley Mobbs is playing us out this week. If you know a talented Iowa band or musician who should be featured on our podcast, please send us a sound file. For the Skeleton Crew, Tom Barton, Sarah Watson, and our producer, Bailey Chihan, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thanks for listening.
Ladies that inspire, impact, and are making a difference across Eastern Iowa. That's her Women of Achievement, an annual community celebration recognizing 13 outstanding women who are leading in unique ways. Join the Gazette for the June 13th celebration. With keynote, Clarissa Chun of the University of Iowa Women's Wrestling Team. Find full details at her.today. That's her.today.